next time I'm here, I'm going to sneak in early so I can participate in the singing beforehand. I got really grateful to Michael Huffill and the people that are becoming part of the Dharma Choir. It's really, really a dream come true. I'm a little bit like low energy because I manifested a hernia after working out this week, so I've got to go in for surgery next week. So I think I'll be okay, but I do have an advance directive. Kaiser makes sure you do. That's good. Some people, you know, like doing Medicine Buddha, so that's fine. I'm also doing Medicine Buddha for everybody here, so we'll just switch back and forth. How's that? I've studied with many different teachers, and also had, you know, my primary teachers in the past passed away, and one thing that I resolved to do is to live as long as possible, but also try to be fairly upfront about health issues, because sometimes people think, well, it's a real benefit to hide your illness or something. And in Dharma, we don't make it, you know, of course, the body is going to fall apart, so that's natural. But, all the teachers I studied with were fairly upfront, you know. I'd ask, you know, how are you doing? And, you know, to my root teacher, he goes, well, I've got diabetes. And he just kind of like say it like that. Or, there aren't any kind of hidden secrets, because many people speculate, you know, it's like, oh, is this, is the teacher really well and they're just faking it or something like that as a teaching, right? So, you know, we don't, if I say I'm feeling, generally people should, if I'm saying I'm feeling okay, I am. If I'm not feeling good, I'll tell you. Isn't that nice? You don't have to speculate, you know. It's much too complicated a life to have many stories running at the same time. So it's just so much easier, ultimately, to just tell the truth. Today I'm going to talk a little bit more about Dhyana Paramita from the Kala Chakra point of view. The Kala Chakra Tantra is one the largest tantra, largest teaching about enlightened society, and about the Enlightened Society of Shambhala. And I've also been asked to teach Monday nights when I'm here, the second and fourth Mondays, about the Lotus Sutra. And these two teachings go together very well. The Lotus Sutra is an enthusiastic, very positive sutra, positive in the sense that it is outlines that it is possible for everyone to wake up to their essential nature, to be a Buddha. It's possible to make real contributions to society. It's possible to know that meaning of life and the nature of the universe. Most importantly, I think Lotus Sutra is completely enthusiastic about the Bodhisattva path. Sometimes the Bodhisattva path is portrayed as just being a better person, less selfish or self-centered, and wanting to extend yourself. And that's true. That's a big part of practice. In the Lotus Sutra, particularly, and in Kala Chakra, the Bodhisattva spirit is actually quite rah-rah and visionary and enthusiastic. So we're the Bodhisattva path isn't just portrayed in a moral way of it's better to be a good person kind of style, but also that it's just the way it's the way the energy of the universe rolls, so to speak. That, the vastness and the profundity and the power and the energy and the delight of the Bodhisattva is the primary motivation to wake up. We want to be happy, and we want others to be happy and free. The distinguishing feature of a tantric approach is that we combine the energy of bliss with the wisdom mind, the knowledge mind, the insight, and that way wake up faster. So this sense of delight and bliss has to be actually, you know, developed from the beginning. So even in the very beginning, we may be confused or we may be in pain, even on our knees or back when sitting, but there's some good feeling generated, or we probably wouldn't come back. So even then, it's important in meditation to point out at the very beginning what we're doing right. In America, Buddhism tends to attract kind of high-minded perfectionists, myself included. But actually, the idea is just to get started. So one of my teachers, who was a Zen priest from Japan, he asked me, "Well, what percentage of energy should?" He asked me, "How much energy should you put in your Dharma practice?" And being kind of gung ho, I'd say, like, I don't know, 110%, like that. He said, "Well, why don't you just start with 5?" So the Mahayana teachings or the whole basis of our practice is also about the generation of this joy and this bliss and sharing our happiness. Because for me, a distinguishing characteristic of Buddha Dharma is that we invite people to experience their liberation and happiness. We invite people to want to stop harming themselves and others. We try not to say, you should, you ought, you have to, you need to. You know, so you should be happy and nice, or you should be liberated, or you ought to, or you're obligated. We invite people and ask people if they would be willing to. This is very traditional Dharma. We ask people if they want to be interested, if they want to be happy and free. But once again, it's all based on openness and willingness. So this initial energy of aspiration and willingness starts at the very beginning. So I want to make it clear that we're not saying, well, you ought to be happy and free, you should be happy and free, you need to be happy and free, you're not a good person if you're not helping others and being happy and free. But we're saying, why don't, would you be interested in experiencing what it is to be awake, happy, and free? And generally, I haven't met anybody really who said no. would you be interested? Why not? So the nice part about the Lotus Sutra is that it's a long enough sutra so that people can get a real sense, but it's not too long that you can't cover it in a year. So so we'll just be reading through it. It has, almost 30 chapters. So that's just about, we'll have it totally covered. How's that? the symbol for our logo for Lion's Roar has a lotus. So I like flowers, and the lotus famously is the symbol for yoga too, right? Isn't it? Like, you know, lotus, and because it's continually blooming and opening. So I'm going to leave some time for some questions and comments and discussion. I'm just going to talk a little bit more. Dhyanaparamita is a Sanskrit word which means far-going or unlimited meditation. And then underneath that are all the different specific kinds of meditation we do. So Dhyanaparamita is not just a technique, but more like an attitude. So if I had to define it, I would say it's your motivation, it's your aspiration to say, well, I'm just going to keep doing this for the rest of my life. So when some people say, I'm interested in taking refuge and you know, being Buddhist, in that particular way of speaking, then I say, well, is this a practice that in some way, even if you're not doing it that great, or even if you think you're enlightened, is it something you want to continue for the rest of your life? Is it somewhat like maybe eating and breathing and sleeping, which generally people want to continue? So that's Dhyanaparamita. It's far going. And then when you think, well, is this a practice that I'd want to continue in my next life? And people go, yeah, this actually is a practice you'd want to continue even if you become fully enlightened, happy, and free, that you continue doing. And you go, yeah. So that's Dhyanaparamita. It means that you're not just practicing in order to come to a particular predetermined awareness or a predetermined place, and then you'd quit or be a parking space. That you'd just keep doing it. In Buddha Dharma, we emphasize that things are ongoing. And that's actually a hard concept to get, because conventional reality and conventional religion too is things start somewhere and then they end. There's a beginning and an end. Like the world was created and then the world's going to be over, you know. And it's kind of neat and tidy, except when things begin and things end, oh, someone's left out. That's the untidy part about it. But in Buddha Dharma, there's actually really no beginning and no end. And there's no beginning to our existence, or the nature of our soul or mind, and there's no end. It's completely ongoing. And that's really hard to kind of accept in a while, because we want to know, like, well, where's, like when we were kids, where does the universe end, right? Anybody remember that as a kid? Like, that, well, okay, there's got to be an end to the universe, and is there a wall there? Is there a sign? You know, it's like, this is the end, you know? And I mean, there are just more galaxies, and some people say, well, no, it's curved, so we never really come to the end. Well, then if it's spherical or like an egg, then there's something on the other side of the shell, right? But the Buddha didn't really get into answering every single metaphysical question, except he talked about things don't have really a beginning and end in reality. The only thing that actually ends is delusion. So because things are diluted, they don't have real existence, and then they can end. So that's what will end. But the nature of mind, the nature of our consciousness or soul, mind, is a continual streaming pulsation that goes on. The Kala Chakra and the Lotus Sutra are trying different ways to talk about interdependence, the fact that things all arise together and disappear together, and then they arise again. So the nature of reality from a Buddhist point of view is that things are rhythmic, or they're pulsating, they're blinking. It appears to go off, but then it appears again. And it appears to last forever, but then it disappears. And this process is eternal. So it's neither completely eternal, nor is it completely gone away. It's interdependent. This is very difficult because we want things black and white. But the energy of the universe is pulsating, and rhythm and pulsating feels good. Don't you think? If you think about any even mundane bliss state, it's because you're in tune or you're rhythmic with it. So that's why so many practices are attuned to the breath, the movement of the body and the belly, and ultimately the movement of the mind. And this pulsating, blissful awareness, that's what we call Buddha. And that's eternal, so it's ongoing. Doesn't mean it's flat, but it's musical. And that goes on forever. It doesn't get boring. It still stays interesting. That's amazing, right? Anything, usually we think, well, I'll get tired of that. But actually, Buddha doesn't get tired of being Buddha. So the dhyana paramita, dhyana is sometimes just called meditation or absorption or samadhi, that ongoing samadhi, that ongoing interdependence, is the nature of reality. It's simple. It feels good and it's easy. There's also a tremendous amount of energy involved. So dhyana paramita isn't just the ongoing nature of awareness, the eternal nature of awareness, but it has tremendous energy. And that's the other unique features about, or very powerful features about Lotus Sutra and Kala Chakra Tantra, is they're very positive in the sense that we do have enough energy to wake up. We do have enough energy to do what we have to do on the planet. We do have enough energy to create a sane and free world. And things aren't just going to, they're not just all going to go downhill. So part of my mission is, I feel I have a special mission to depressed Buddhists. Why I'm in Sacramento? Well, I have a mission. Sacramento energy is a little bit sometimes flat, right? It's not not energetic like San Francisco or New York or even L.A. It tends to be, you know, Kala Chakra talks about the cosmic energy and the elemental energy. It tends to be a little bit flat. No one's disagreeing. The good news about flat and flat land, flat energy, is that you become dramatically aware of you know, how you have to, you can, and you have to, you know, be responsible for, you know, creating your own energy or getting in touch with your true rhythmic energy. But the tendency is to become confluent with the energy of the environment. So I have to continually kind of say, no, actually, this is the universe, it's not getting worse. Or it's not, the energy actually isn't, our basic energy isn't always flat. So it's a little bit, Lotus Sutra and Kala Chakra go along with my personality because I want to cheer people up a little bit. Yes, you know, politics may not always be the way we want it. Our body, our karmic breakdown, we have problems at home, da-da-da-da-da. But actually, there's also complete openness, complete freedom, and complete awareness, too, that it's not all falling apart. So at one point, I wanted to do a survey, kind of psychological survey. Are you a dysthymic Buddhist? I mean, you know, kind of that means like low-grade depression, and do you need Dharma Prozac or something? because in our Mahayana school, we do acknowledge pain and suffering. Yes, we acknowledge we have health issues, but at the same time, it's a heroic stance because we can tell the truth about our situation without shame. We can tell other people what's going on with us without shame, and we can testify and witness to this blissful wisdom energy, and we don't have to dumb it down a little bit. We don't have to apologize for being whoever we are. So Lotus Sutra and Kala Chakra go well together because these kind of positive statements. So I'm going to stop here and see if I'm in my delusional state or whether I'm speaking to what you need to hear. So there can be questions, comments, or as I say, discussion or complaints. Yeah, it's okay to have good feelings in meditation, you know. Sometimes people ask me that, like, I don't want to be attached to feeling too good. I don't. You won't. You actually won't be. I mean, we get attached to delusions, like thinking a regular sensation of pleasure will last forever. But you actually, the good news is, you actually can't get attached to reality. So you won't really actually become attached to too much good feelings because why? They're pulsating, they'll disappear for a while and then they'll come back. You might get attached to your delusion that the earth is flat, but I want people, when we do a meditation here, like, if you're feeling good, you know, like, oh, then you can take a joy in that, right? Because I met too many Buddhists in Sacramento and around that said, well, I'm feeling really good, but I don't want to become attached to it. So it's okay. Yeah.
Thank you. when you're in a group, as opposed to just by yourself, it's kind of that way. How do you use teams in a group?
Susan's asking a question like, why does it feel different when we're with a group? Actually, we people emit energy. I mean, they actually, you know, it isn't just kind of psychological, like I feel more support, and or I'm too embarrassed to get up and leave in the middle of a meditation because people are here. Actually, you know, people are you know, putting out, it sounds kind of 70s or 60s, but people are putting out good vibrations, and it actually, we pick up on it. And most of the time, people are putting out pretty good energy or they wouldn't be here, you know, so it's inspirational. I mean, there's a psychological piece, like, if we're with a group and we've driven here, we're not going to, you know, go, you know, check our Facebook or email or something, but people are actually putting out good energy. Can you, you know, if you sit next to somebody for a while, you'll start vibrating with them. Yeah. Yeah.
But the energies are not necessarily
the nice part is about like being in high energy places is we get, you know, we pick that up too, but then the downside is you don't have to generate it yourself. So the nice thing about Sacramento is that like generally we have to generate a lot of energy, you know, ourselves. So you're really in touch with it. Where, you know, if we said, oh, I wish I was in, you know, a big city, or I wish I was in India or Dharamsala or the monastery, there's so much sometimes energy generated that we don't have to do it ourselves. And that can be a problem, that we become dependent upon it. You know, we really tend to become confluent with the energy that we're at. You know, we just end up, even if we think we're making choices and mind states or even in clothes, you know, if we saw a picture of us now, we'd go, whoa, I was really dressing like that in 2017, you know? Even though we're not thinking like, let's dress 2017, you would look, you would go, oh yeah, that's how my hair was in 2017. Yeah, it's like, whoa. It's true, isn't it? We tend to be confluent. So whenever we're dealing with energy, that we have to notice, like, it's supportive and challenging, but also we tend to be confluent with it. So it's important in art school, like, to practice as a group, but then also practice alone. Brian, sorry. Okay. Yeah. I know. At first I thought it was interesting. Like, my field versus all my, you know, so. Hey, Brian. Yeah. 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 You know, using my kind of pulsating light idea, both on and off, it's really weird, but both on and off, come on, they're happening at the same time. Because we usually look at things linear, like now it's on, now it's off, you know, and off follows on and on follows off, right? We usually think that way. It, cause and effect happens simultaneously. It's really weird. And like everything arises, like everything's here just at the same time. It isn't kind of linear like we think evolutionary all the time. It's everything's happening at the same time. So to understand this, we have to see things from their opposite side and hold them together at the same time, at least, you know, evenly, and that's called shamatha practice. So, you know, everything is like, you know, stubbing your toe and seeing the Grand Canyon at the same time, you know, or worse. You know, everything is like totally falling apart and then totally arising at the same time. So we've got cancer and it's a beautiful day at the same time. And they actually don't alternate. This is what's really strange is that it looks, I mean, to talk about interdependence and to talk about rhythm, you know, we have to kind of flatten it out so it feels like this happens and this happens because our life manifests in time. And that's why we need Kala Chakra to talk about, well, how does this eternal world and time interrelate? But in beginning practice, we have to kind of, in some sense, a little bit artificially separate them. And whenever we say yes, we have to also think no at the same time. So that's why, you know, you have like, you know, like how many Zen students does it take to turn on a light bulb and one to turn it on and one not to. So, so yeah, we have to train ourselves to do that because it's very natural for us to dwell on one polarity and just go, well, it's great. And then I don't want to look over here with, you know, painful or yes, it's painful. And that totally eliminates all the pleasurable aspects. So in doing shamatha practice, we start out by, of course, increasing our ability to concentrate and focus. But then, for people who know that have worked with me for a while, I'm always going to get them to try to identify some, at least some pleasurable place in their body and painful place at the same time. Because we usually do. I mean, even if we're in, you know, extreme pain somewhere, there's some place that is neutral and there's some place that actually may be a little pleasurable. And to hold that in consciousness at the same time without having one on top of the other. So usually in beginning practice, you know, in the West, you know, they call mindfulness, you know, you're just trying to pay attention to one thing at a time. And that's starting. But actually to do what we call shamatha, which serenity meditation is, you then have to become aware of two things at the same time. And it's really possible to do that, you know, and the mind is doing that all the time. But we tend to alternate or we tend to put one thing on top of another, so to speak, or things get meshed or things get really widely split apart. So to shamatha meditation, as we say in Sanskrit or Shine in Tibetan, the serenity meditation is where the two opposites have, you know, kind of just sat down together evenly in equanimity. And then the next step is we kind of, in a sense, look between the two in the middle. So Tantra works on this too because it works with opposite energies. Instead of trying to eliminate all the bad energy, so to speak, we use it to balance the mind, and it's like two magnets. I don't know, maybe electrician is here, and if you get them spinning, they'll generate, the magnets will, like copper wire, and then it'll generate electricity. So you want to always be able to bring the opposites into balance. And that's hard to do because this society is always like either or, and it does take some faith to say, okay, that sounds crazy and impossible, but I'm willing to do it. And that's why bodhisattvas need, you know, kind of this this encouragement and enthusiasm that they're kind of, I can do it, kind of feel. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah. That's why you need to come to class. Actually, we just become kind of keep getting familiar with it. You know, it is, once again, it's dhyana paramita. You just kind of keep doing it. I mean, that's why so much of really teachers will just say, keep doing it. And then we're just saying, well, when are we going to get there? Or I'm discouraged. And we have to just say, keep doing it. So that's also like, you know, that's why we say in Kalachakra, you can journey to Shambhala and then get revised, or in the Lotus Sutra, we can go to a pure land and get energized like that. Roberta had a question, and then we can take a break. An important part of the practice here, important part of what we call tantra or continuity, is the same thing, keep going, is continuity, is how to store the positive energy states. So as yogis, as practitioners, we do need to be kind of like camels, you know. So, you know, like in reference to your question, we just don't let go of the energy. So we don't want to let go of insights, and we want to store energy states. You know, so we can keep going in dry times. Yeah, we should, you know, stretch for 10 minutes, and then you can talk and stretch. I'm just going to sit here a bit, and then we'll start. We'll do our meditation afterwards. Is that okay? All right. Just a few brief pointers. In shamatha meditation, calm abiding, we can start off by just becoming aware of our breath rhythm. But I want to point out a few other things. It's also becoming aware of when we're breathing in fully, and then we're aware of like, okay, now I'm full, and then we're also aware of now my breath is dissolved into, you know, gone out and dissolved into space, and we're aware of that. And the interesting thing is that when we're breathing out naturally, we still probably have, like, let's say you breathe out for 5 seconds, you probably have 10 more seconds of breath, actually, if you pushed it all the way out. I don't want you to do that, but it's like you want to be aware that even when you naturally give out, there's still more energy left. So when we're saying, kind of let the breath go out, you don't tip over. Yeah, you become awareness that even though you've given out enough to the environment, you've given your CO2 back or whatever, you could give out twice as much. And that's what I mean by don't give more than 49%. So you always have this feeling that you still have enough energy to, you know, lift a small building like that. Whatever Superman does, or Supergirl or something. So when we're letting go of the breath, to go out. You're not pushing it out until you're exhausted. You're letting it flow out, knowing that still you still have plenty of energy left. That makes sense, right? Okay. So we can have a nice short meditation. Thank you.